Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Jordan Carr Morse, a director and editor and the founder of Eyes and Ears, a production company committed to forwarding progressive political and social movements. Jordan has worked as a cinematographer and editor on commercials and films that have been screened around the world and is currently directing his first feature-length documentary, The Israeli, about the journey of Israeli-American activist and author Miko Peled. From Zionist to Palestinian rights activist. There will be a sneak peek at the work in progress tonight, Monday, July 7th, at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, and along with that, a screening of Jordan's short film, The Orphan, which follows 90-year-old Holocaust survivor Jacques Boud as he recounts his time in post-war Israel and why his experience with genocide compelled him to the Palestinian cause. That film was directed by Carr Morse and produced by Peled. After the films, there will be a Q&A with the director and a panel discussion featuring local activists. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Jordan Carr Morse.
Thank you so much for having me.
These are both really splendid films. The Orphan is quite beautiful. The Israeli is fascinating, and I really want to see more of it. Peled produced the short film, The Orphan. Can you talk about how you came to meet and work together and came to make the documentary, The Israeli?
Yeah, sure. I first met Miko working on another film by a Palestinian filmmaker named Ali Al-Aryan, and we interviewed Miko in Washington, D.C. Miko sort of was interested in that work, and he had a funder who wanted to sort of promote his work, and they reached out to me to make some short online explainer videos, sort of Israel-Palestine 101 shorts for YouTube. And so Ollie and Miko and I wrote some scripts that Miko would read, and I flew out to Washington, D.C. to have Miko read these. And we put the scripts up on a teleprompter and started to record, and it sort of just wasn't working that well. So after sort of an hour or so of not being crazy about what we were recording, I ended up throwing the scripts away and just having Miko talk to me. And he ended up over the course of a couple of days kind of telling me his whole journey, his whole life story. And what we recorded was probably the most compelling interview I'd ever seen, ever heard. And it was moving. It was something that you could just sit and watch for minutes and minutes at a time, unedited, and just be glued to it. So once we'd done that, we realized we hadn't really made these short explainer videos we had set out to make, but what we had was the basis for a much bigger story. So we took the next several years at this point, sort of reverse engineering that one long form interview into the Israeli, into this film. And that entailed visiting Palestine with Miko a couple of times and touring all across Europe and the United States, sort of following his speaking tour and his journey in order to sort of flesh out that story and bring it to life. So that's how we did it.
So there are parts of the film that you filmed in Palestine and around Europe and Israel. Part of what we see in the Israeli is the experience that Miko has of going into the West Bank, going into Palestinian territory, and grappling with his own fears about that, with the difficulty of that experience. What was it like for you as a filmmaker going into places that are quite restricted? I mean, there are checkpoints, there are gates. Were there problems with getting visas? How did you go about going to the West Bank and making the film there?
Yeah, great question. Well, it was a bit of a trick. We went twice in February and then I believe in August of 2022. And this was right on the tail end of COVID, really. Or, well, we were still in the middle of COVID, but as you might recall, Israel was probably the most strict country in terms of restricting travel in and out and movement within the country at that time. So we had scheduled the trip several times and had to cancel it because they would lift the COVID ban and then put it back in place. So it was difficult to get there both times. But once we got in, oh, I should note also that as a filmmaker, you're not really supposed to go to Israel and make a film. You need official approval from the state in order to bring in a crew and equipment and things like that on paper. So what we decided to do, we knew we weren't going to get that permission given, you know, who Miko is, and he's pretty well known in Israel. So we decided to sort of sneak in. I ended up buying really small, kind of mini versions of all the equipment you might need. So microphones and cameras and all little things. So they looked like sort of consumer grade tools that a tourist might bring in just to sort of, you know, take photos and things like that. So we kind of smuggled that stuff in. But once we got there, it was really fascinating because, you know, you hear stories about how restricted or how dangerous or things like that traveling inside Palestine was. And at that time, at least, I think it's probably changed a lot since then. But when we were there, we actually had really no problem traveling anywhere we wanted to go. And this is something Miko discovered, I think, early on in his journey, that even though he was told his whole life that it was dangerous to visit Palestinian towns and that he was risking his life if he did so, once you go and do it, you realize that that's just not the case at all. I mean, we went all over the place. We went to Hebron, we went to Bethlehem, we traveled all over the West Bank. And what we found, I mean, what Miko had already known, but what I discovered was that everyone was incredibly welcoming and generous, and we never felt in danger or at risk sort of at all. So, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about what Palestine is and what it's like and who the people are and things like that. I will say that it was a subject that I think I felt I understood on paper. I felt like I had the sort of right politics on it, I guess, going in, but it was a whole other thing to sort of see it for yourself and to see what Palestinians have to live with day to day. I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, the apartheid is just tangible. I mean, you can see it in a thousand tiny ways every day, from the streets that, they can walk down or can't walk down in their own towns, where their family has lived for generations, to the roads that they can or can't use, to who can marry whom. I mean, they're restricted to travel between different parts of the West Bank by the Israeli occupation. So it's really quite shocking.
So the restrictions on mobility really apply to Palestinians, not to Israelis, not to visitors and
That's
tourists
right.
and
That's
people
right.
with
I mean,
meals.
as a couple of basically white guys, nobody looked twice at us. We could go right through checkpoints. We could drive wherever we wanted. Of course, if you're a Palestinian, that's not at all the case. So yeah, I like to think about it in terms of maybe capitalizing on some of our white privilege there to try and tell a story that, makes a difference.
And the process of coming to understand what it's like there, the transition from having a sense of it on paper, of the abstract understanding, to really experiencing it and internalizing it, is something that also seems to be part of Miko Peled's journey. I mean, he goes from having been raised as a Zionist to becoming an advocate for Palestinian rights. And there's a good deal in the film about the difficulty of that process and how it is a process. It's not simply a momentary discovery and enlightenment ensues, but there's a kind of repeated iteration of grappling with his own fears, with his own assumptions, and working through those. Tell us a little bit about Miko's story, where he starts and how he starts to move away from that initial training in Zionist beliefs.
Yeah, Miko's story is fascinating for a number of reasons, but one of them is that his starting point in his journey was, I mean, he wasn't just a Zionist. The founding of the State of Israel for Miko was a family affair. His relatives, his parents, his grandparents, his aunts, his uncles played key roles in the establishment of the Israeli state. His grandfather signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. And his father was a nationally famous war hero general, was, I believe, the highest ranking military officer that one could be, helped build the IDF. So Miko grew up in the very heart of the sort of Zionist movement, right? His grandparents were some of the first Israelis. So coming from there, I think it made it particularly difficult to get outside of that. And it made it particularly difficult for him to hear stories of Palestinians that clashed with the version of history that he was brought up with. All he was told by the people who lived it was the story of Israel as this heroic effort to make the desert bloom and grow a country from sort of nothing into this booming, industrial, modern, democratic place. And he had no reason to doubt that, really. I mean, he felt like he owned the truth, that he had lived the truth. There was no debate about it. And the really pivotal point in Miko's story was in the mid-90s, when his 13-year-old niece was killed in a suicide bomb attack by Hamas in Jerusalem. And that obviously rocked everyone's world who was around that. It changed Miko's life to the point where he needed to seek out and find answers to this. And so for the first time in his life, he went and sought out and started to meet Palestinians. I mean, even though he grew up in Jerusalem, there are plenty of Palestinians, but it's very segregated. So he never really met Palestinians. And as he began to do this, he would hear the stories that the Palestinians would tell and their version of history and what their parents had experienced. And it was not just a little bit different, it was the opposite of what Miko had been brought up believing. And that was a tough thing to hear, right? I mean, how do you deal with that? And so for Miko, he describes it as this very slow and painful process, and one that he likens to losing a limb. He had to sort of completely reject so much of his identity and then rebuild it with something else and replace it with something else. And so for Miko, that something else was activism and was joining the Palestinian cause and eventually devoting his whole life to the Palestinian cause.
It seems like there must have been some movement in the direction of skepticism and exploration and questioning within his family when this happened. There's a scene of his niece's parents being asked about their reaction to the killing, and the journalists clearly expect them to be calling for revenge. These are the children of this great general, and the general's granddaughter has been killed by Hamas, so surely they're going to call for revenge. And her mother, I guess Miko's sister, says, "I don't want any mother to feel this. I don't want revenge." So there, it seems like there's some movement in the family toward questioning, toward thinking about things a little bit differently, even before that bombing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because Miko's whole family really were and are liberals. They are liberal Zionists for the most part. And even his father, General Matti Peled, was sort of famous for being anti-war. He always advocated for making peace with the Palestinians. He thought it was foolish, much of what Israel was doing in terms of continuously expanding and dominating the Palestinians. And, you know, a lot of his family was on the same page. I mean, they were skeptical of a lot of what might call the excesses of more recent regimes in Israel. But, you know, this is one of the subtler points the film explores, which is that a lot of people will tell Miko that they agree with him on, you know, 90 or 95% of what he says, but that he goes too far. And a big part of Miko's story was rejecting even the liberal form of Zionism and realizing that the entire project of Zionism is flawed, that it has racism essentially built into the very foundation of it. And in order to overcome that, in order to actually sort of get right with his own morality, he had to reject this project entirely. And that process is something that has alienated Miko from his liberal Zionist family. They see him as now having gone way too far, and they sort of see him as anti-Semitic and hateful and things like that. Yeah, so there was a skepticism. You know, there was a very liberal tendency within his family even before this event. But that event really set Miko on a path that would see him compelled to oppose Zionism at its most fundamental level. And that's really the point of the story, I think. I mean, it's that Miko's story is one that I think will help a lot of people who are on the fence on this issue, you know, help them move off the fence and realize that the problem is not Netanyahu, you know, not extreme religious forms of Zionism. The problem is Zionism, full stop, just the whole project.
So if his development and changes have alienated him from his family, is that does that include the liberal Zionist family is not accepting of his rejection of Zionism?
Well, you know, I think, you know, his relationship, I think, really frayed in the wake of October 7th. So in the wake of October 7th, we were seeing all of these stories very uncritically spread in Western media about, you know, mass rape and mass murder and the sort of craven behavior that Palestinians who were attacking from Gaza were committing. And Miko was very skeptical of these stories right from the outset. As some of the most sensationalist stories were appearing in the press, Miko was very publicly saying, I don't believe this. We shouldn't believe the Israeli state. I mean, when they tell us what's happening, we should know better. And, you know, he was familiar enough with who these attackers were. I mean, with, you know, who Hamas is and who the Palestinian militants were, that he didn't really buy whole cloth a lot of these stories like a lot of people did. And he's been proven correct on that. I mean, we've seen a lot of debunking of a lot of those stories. But in the wake of that traumatic event for the Israeli population, any sort of skepticism or any sort of apology or defense of Palestinians broadly was seen as just really offensive. Miko was publicly casting doubt on some of these stories and still talking about his deep and steadfast commitment to Palestinian freedom, right? Which is the real thing we ought to be talking about in relation to October 7th. His family basically disowned him for that. They saw him as a sort of Holocaust denier, as an anti-Semite. And as far as I'm aware, at least, I mean, the last time I spoke to Miko about it, he essentially is not in contact with his family in Israel anymore. And on top of that, he has been advised that he should not return to Israel. They've changed some of the laws and made some of the things Miko was saying now treasonous. So, you know, Miko can't go home. And that's quite a sacrifice to make for his beliefs. And so, yeah, you'll see all that in the movie.
Yeah, I'm struck by some of the parallels between US developments and Israeli developments. And he talks about having grown up on the privileged side of this divide, and there were Palestinians in his environment, but they didn't seem like people. They were the construction workers and the gardeners and doing certain kinds of labor that immigrants often do in the US. That there was this category of people who were not really seen as human, who were dirty and sick and lazy. And he comments that the term in Hebrew for bad workmanship is Arab workmanship. That is sort of tremendous propaganda against that group. So to then make the transition to getting to know Palestinians and to understanding their experience and realizing that they did not leave voluntarily, which he apparently had been taught and believed at one point, is quite a striking journey. And there are striking parallels with some of the messaging that we're getting in the US. So that Israel, in its exclusion of him, in its constraints on free speech, seems to be just a few steps ahead of the direction that the US may be moving at this point. So these are lessons for activists, for viewers of the film, things that can help us come to understand what's going on there, how we are ourselves potentially implicated in this. Can you talk about the role that you see for cinema and for documentary in helping to move people and raise awareness and contribute to change in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that compelled me to do both of these stories, both Miko's story and Jacques' story, is that they are both perspectives that I think cut through a lot of the noise, a lot of the propaganda that we're exposed to in this country, especially. These are both Jewish people who have deep experiences with the history of Zionism and, you know, are speaking about it from a position of deep understanding. I mean, they lived these stories. And what I find so compelling about them is that I think, you know, they're really powerful tools for moving people who might be on the fence off of the fence. If you had any sort of doubts about what the state of Israel and the project of Zionism are really about, these stories can really inform you. These two stories can really inform you. And in terms of Miko's story, his story really mirrors, I think, the process that a lot of Americans also have to go through. The parallels are pretty striking. I mean, it's a story about realizing that where you grew up and the things that you were told to value and believe are not what they seem. These are both settler colonial countries, and it's sort of about waking up to what that means. And, you know, the parallels in terms of the sort of racism and othering of particular ethnic groups, I think all stem from that process. How is this country built? Who is it built for? And what does that mean for prospects of democracy and justice and things like this? You know, Miko, because I think he's gone through that process that a lot of Americans have to go through. I think it's really resonant for an American audience. I mean, he's speaking to everyday Americans who are not necessarily initiated in this. He starts from scratch. He starts from the same starting point that Americans have to start with on this issue. We're just sort of born into this culture where Zionism is just sort of accepted without question. We're just told Israel is is a noble project, and that the Israelis are the good guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys and the terrorists. And, you know, a lot of people never really question that. So Miko's story, I think, really speaks to, you know, everybody's aunt and mom and uncle and anybody who is maybe starting out where we all start out, right? And that's where I think these stories can be helpful. I mean, there are a lot of great films that have been made on this topic, a lot, especially just in the last couple of years. But what I'm hoping that these films can do is really try and reach a broader audience who maybe don't know the first thing about any of this, and sort of bring folks up to speed in a way that they can relate with. And, you know, I think that broader project is just really critical right now. I mean, I think it's becoming clearer every day that Zionism is a force that needs to be confronted. It's controlling politics in this country, right? I mean, it's the reason Donald Trump is president. It's the reason we're going to war with Iran. These are deeply tied to Zionism. So I don't know how we get out of this exactly, but I know that growing a movement of people who see clearly what's happening and are motivated to act is where we start.
And what are the next steps for the Israeli? And you're working on this film in addition to the interviews that you've done with Miko, with others. There's archival footage. Where is the process of completing the film?
Thank you. So we are currently in post-production. So we've filmed everything we're going to film, and we are now in the process of putting the final touches on the edit. And then we've got things like music production and licensing of archival materials and legal clearances and all the sort of boring stuff that goes into really finishing a film that can be released broadly. So what we're trying to do with this screening is to start to raise funds to get this done and get it out. This is very much an independent project. You know, something to note is that this film was largely a sort of one-man band sort of project. I mean, I was the camera person and the director and the sound recordist and the editor and yada yada. So it was basically me with a little camera following Miko around for a couple of years. We didn't have much money, and this screening is to kind of kickstart our crowdfunding campaign and hopefully put us in a position where we can get this thing finished and out to a broad audience within the next 6 months or so.
Great. Tickets are only $10 at the Clinton Street and will benefit that project of getting those clearances and getting things licensed and so on. And again, so Monday, July 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, The Israeli sneak peek and the short film, The Orphan. There will be a Q&A after the film, as well as a panel discussion with local activists. Thank you so much for talking with us, Jordan Carr Morse.
Thank you, Fran. I really appreciate it.